Tonight on Basic Black, from anger.
The death of killing black men in this country, you can only put so much into a pressure cooker before it pops.
To resilience.
Last night was a very rough period for our city. But today, I think we saw a lot more of what Baltimore is about.
To a call for calm.
If our society really wanted to solve the problem, it would require everybody saying this is important, this is significant.
To a step toward resolution.
We have probable cause to file criminal charges.
Basic Black looks at the lessons to be learned from the eruptions in Baltimore on race, class, and rebuilding community. That's our conversation coming up.
Our panel tonight: Philip Martin, senior reporter, WGBH News; Peniel Joseph, professor of history, Tufts University; Callie Crossley, host, Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, 89.7 WGBH; Philip Atiba Goff, associate professor of social psychology, UCLA, and visiting scholar at the Kennedy School of Government; and Kim McLaren, associate professor of writing, literature, and publishing, Emerson College. To join the conversation, please visit our website at basicblack.org.
Well, I want to start out by just a quick update on what's happened in Baltimore. So Marilyn Mosby, the state's attorney, has come out, and she has levied charges against six police officers. And I wanted us to start right off by hearing from her.
The findings of our comprehensive, thorough, and independent investigation, coupled with the medical examiner's determination that Mr. Gray's death was a homicide, which we received today, has led us to believe that we have probable cause to file criminal charges.
All right, so we've had a week of ups and downs in Baltimore. now this, after a lot of leaked information that I believe is not correct, but now Marilyn Mosby has stepped forward. So where are we now? Let's start with you, Peniel.
Well, I think that this Friday was sort of a capstone to what started Monday with Freddie Gray's funeral, and then peaceful demonstrations the previous week sort of devolved into escalating violence. By Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, this became a national story, and people were wondering, why are all these black people rioting in Baltimore? Mainstream news media painted African Americans as thugs. Some people said that thug was a new N-word. But social media did something really extraordinary, presented an alternative narrative of what was going on in Baltimore. You saw young people reading, people singing, you saw clergy, you saw LGBT, you saw white students and white people participating. So you saw this massive sort of social movement in Baltimore, and there's been protests in Seattle, in Minneapolis, in Philadelphia. So there's a movement. This is very reminiscent, I tell my students, to the 1960s, but it's updated. It's millennials, yeah. It's social media, it's Facebook. So I think that the state's attorney just did was provide a capstone and really prove that Black Lives Matter, in the sense that this person didn't kill themselves. Freddie Gray did not murder himself, and we were hearing that almost as if it was factual evidence just yesterday.
And let me remind people that three of his vertebrae were crushed, and his voice box was, he couldn't speak. So obviously something else happened. Mm-hmm. We've been looking at all of this, everything that's happened since Ferguson, in the context of Ferguson, Phil Goff. Should Baltimore be considered in the same context?
Absolutely. Okay. It needs to be considered in the same context. So when we talk about these things, what we've been talking about is, well, there's racism, and we're seeing it in policing. There's racial discrimination, because we're not seeing a lot of unarmed white men being treated this way. And in fact, we've seen a couple of really what should be uncontroversial and unremarkable videos of white men who are armed being treated with what seems to be more respect than black men who are unarmed. But what I like about the way that even mainstream media has been forced to talk about Baltimore is that it pulls the lens back a little bit. And it says that if we have a problem of racism in policing, which we do, then we also have it in employment and education and in healthcare. And all those things happen upstream of policing. So if you want to understand the rage that lives in a community, you have to understand that it doesn't start with a police encounter, right? It starts with the way that the state is organized to respect the dignity of the lives that live there. And so what's happening in Baltimore, and I've been incredibly impressed with the poetry coming out of the mouths of several of the folks who were just, you know, in these on the street interviews, saying we had 9 days of peaceful protests, and you started paying attention when things went up in smoke. And with that self-realization, that self-possession, comes, I think, the ability to start articulating some of the difficulties, the struggles that are not just at that moment of contact. It's not about the individual death, but that death highlights for people. It becomes the capstone for folks, or the touchstone to make the rest of their lives and their humanity visible.
So what does it mean that when we have talked about and seen these incidents across the country, the dynamic is usually black community, white officers, white city officials. Baltimore is different. Baltimore is black city officials. Presumably these are folks in charge, and black community, and yet we have a scenario that's very much, as Phil has just said, in the context of Ferguson.
Well, it doesn't challenge the idea that these problems are institutionalized and systemic. It actually proves that, right? That it proves the point. I think I don't understand people who say, well, because there's a black mayor and a black police commissioner, it's not relevant. It actually proves that it goes beyond individual problems, that these things are, and as Phil was saying, that it goes beyond policing. Of course, the over-militarization of the police, the warrior mentality of the police, the disregard for black lives, these are all problematic regardless of who's at the top, and that it needs to be rooted out on that level. And the other thing I wanted to say that Phil said is that what's powerful about Baltimore and the reason it continues what's going on is Ferguson is we're seeing these citizens in the street challenge the narrative in the mainstream media in real time. Mm-hmm. And that has been extraordinary. Yeah. Just average, ordinary people confronting Geraldo Rivera and all these people and challenging narrative in real time. And that is extremely powerful, that narrative did not go unchecked, right? This narrative about he killed himself and you people are rioting and destroying your own neighborhood. In real time, that was challenged. And I think that is one of the most extraordinary things.
Now, given all that's been said, what does it mean then for Marilyn Mosby to come out today and say, because there would have been a lot of conversation that no information would be released to the public. That was said a couple of days ago, that this was information was going to go straight to the prosecutor, and you guys just have to wait till we are finished the investigation. But when she comes out today, Philip, what happens here?
As a single act, it was remarkable, as a single act. That is to say, you've had seven black men who died before this incident, this latest incident in Baltimore. This is the first time that an officers in this case, where the state's attorney feel it is that she has evidence where she can in fact file homicide charges against these individuals. I'm not sure the circumstances of the seven other men who died before, but Baltimore is more than any other city, by the way, more than any other city, has an extraordinary reputation and an extraordinary series of histories regarding the police and African Americans. Just absolutely amazing. It's unprecedented.
It was written up, by the way, we should say, an in-depth report by the Baltimore Sun last year.
Before all of this happened.
Higher than two nearby cities, Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia, and higher than 200 other cities across the country, including Boston, of course. Boston, by comparison, there are problems in Boston, but when you juxtapose it with Baltimore, it's comparatively mild. But let me say this: the problem is much larger. The problem is that black communities are still criminalized. That's what we're really dealing with here. It's the issue of criminalization. The fact that police continue, regardless of sometimes of the training, to look at black communities through the prisms of stereotypes and the failure to look at the economic connectivity, the lack of opportunity. And when I say lack of opportunity, I don't mean rhetorically. I'm talking about an opportunity, the failure to provide jobs to people based on any number of factors, including racism. These are the factors that have to be considered. And let me also consider another factor, and that is the failure to look at this in a federal federal context. Almost nothing can be done in terms of really curtailing police violence. You can go community by community, but until there are stronger federal laws that prevent police homicides against unarmed citizens, unarmed black men, so on and so forth, you're really going to have a problem in terms of dealing with police violence.
Can you roll that back?
I can roll that back.
No, not you. I'm saying to Phil Goff over here, can that can the militarization be rolled back at this point through the feds alone?
Okay, so yeah. There's so much here, and I'm glad to be part of the conversation. There's so much here I got to pick on one of them. So to your question, can you roll back the militarization? Understand that the militarization component, which is an equipment thing, at least people talk about the mindset, but really the equipment is the thing that's been so visible. That's a tool, and it can be used incredibly powerfully. So in Ferguson, there's this famous footage of officers, they actually weren't Ferguson PD, but there were officers that packed up a bunch of journalists and put them into a Bearcat, right? To be clear, what happened was they called the police. It was Al Jazeera. And they were concerned because there were folks who were making anti-Muslim statements. Mm. They were concerned for their safety. And there were, the reason why they were able to be shown is because there were newscasters across the street who were not Muslim, not associated with Al Jazeera, who felt perfectly comfortable. They brought the Bearcat in to make sure that people were safely taken out. So it's not that I'm in favor of militarization of law enforcement, of municipal law enforcement, but we got to understand it as a tool. To your point, though, of we need some federal understanding of this.
A federal guidelines.
Right, so federal guidelines of this. There are federal guidelines for what constitutes racial profiling, but where is the enforcement component?
Well, McCluskey says you can. I mean, I think that one of the big things that's going on here is this. Hillary Clinton just did a speech on the 23rd anniversary of the Rodney King riots, the L.A. rebellion at Columbia University. She called for an end to mass incarceration. She was echoing the work of Vesla Weaver, Michelle Alexander, Khalil Muhammad, all these different people who've talked about ending mass incarceration. A couple of things. The way in which mass incarceration, the short story, how did this happen? Through the drug wars in the 80s and 90s, two crime bills, 82 and 86, passed with bipartisan support. More punitive sentencing if you were doing crack cocaine than powder cocaine.
Right.
In the 90s, Bill Clinton, 1994 omnibus crime bill, 1996 welfare reform. Those two things have successfully criminalized the entire African-American community. One of the things that we're seeing now is that poor black neighborhoods are literal hunting grounds for the police. Certainly Chicago and all the murders that we see in Chicago, and there's been more murders in Chicago over the last 12 years than Americans, soldiers were killed in Afghanistan and Iraq. They say black on black crime, they're talking about poor people who are so impoverished and so isolated economically and racially segregated that the violence that they're doing to each other is a direct result of what Philip was talking about, a lack of opportunity, but tangible opportunities. But what the federal government has done is amplified this criminalization, right? And this is a gateway. Our criminal justice system is a gateway to racial oppression. That's what we're seeing. It's connected to public schools. It's connected to welfare. It's connected to child support payments. It's connected to drug rehabilitation. To jobs. Mm-hmm. And so what Baltimore shows us is that we need two things. We need to decriminalize the justice system, but we also need a massive New Deal style Works Progress Administration and public works jobs for everyone, including African-American teenagers. Teenage unemployment is a crisis in this country, black teenage unemployment. So what we need is a political fundamental reform in the United States that's transformational.
Let me suggest that everything you said here is absolutely on point, and it's something that maybe a small group of people know. What do incidents like Baltimore do to get beyond someone was shot in the street and there's criminalization going on, but to understanding the issues behind that? Has anything happened in terms of the general shift of understanding of where a Baltimore comes from?
Well, you know? I think President Obama's comments, which I was pleased to see, had a problem with the use of the word thugs, but let's not go there, right?
We can go there in a minute.
You know, began, I wish he had gone further, but he began to push it, that conversation. The question is, what do we do from here, right? Because what we immediately get pushed back into the usual, nattering about this is a culture problem, right? That this is a problem of black culture as opposed to a problem of economic opportunity, which Peniel so gladly liked. So the question is, can we get beyond that, you know, that argument? I think the only thing that I've seen so far that has happened is that the president has articulated that. Does that mean that in his waning days he will push for more federal investment in into our cities? I don't know.
On the police front, I think Eric Holder started to look at police police violence in any number of places. New Orleans.
Now we have Loretta Lynch, and she's not nearly as. I agree.
She's certainly. But we
also have Vanita Gupta, who's the acting assistant attorney general for civil rights, and is going to be nominated as the assistant attorney general for civil rights, who was the person who was lead in the Tulia case.
We had the person who got
Rick Perry to exonerate a town full of black people, who's running the civil rights division. Mm-hmm. So Eric Holder went way further than the beginning. Yeah. Eric Holder's secret agenda, to the degree that there's a secret agenda, was to right the wrongs of a civil rights division that had been absolutely moribund on these issues.
Absolutely. Done a whole ton of stuff.
And what he discovered, and what I think many of us are discovering, is that while you're quite right, Peniel, that the federal government put a whole bunch of things into place that exacerbated the problems of urban poverty, right, and made it extreme. What they didn't put in place was sets of regulations and sets of accountability for anybody.
Right.
We got 18,000 police departments in this country, 75% of which have 25 or fewer officers, and there are no federal standards by which they are held to account, not even for data collection. So in 86, when the crime bill comes out, there is no component that says, yes, you can do this. We're going to give you funding for doing the drug war, but we're not going to require that you give us any data on that.
And here's the other problem. Eric Holder discovered that when you're trying to prosecute police violence, in the D.J. Henry case, for example, the youth here at Easton, the Justice Department 2 weeks ago decided they could not pursue charges against the police officer in this case. Why? Because the threshold proof is dramatic on a federal level after a grand jury in Westchester County refused to indict the officer involved. Even though there's, from the civil case, we know there's clear evidence to suggest that there's something extremely problematic about this case. The same thing is true in Ferguson. The same is true with cases around the country. They find that the threshold of proof is dramatic.
Right.
And so that has to change.
And be in Baltimore as well.
In Baltimore as well.
But it's a different threshold.
Well, but he's been in, yes. Yeah. Okay.
So there's a criminal threshold, which is actually lower than the civil rights threshold.
Right.
The reason why DOJ can't get involved in the shooting is because the threshold for saying that you took a life and that violated the civil rights in, on top of that, you have to be using a racial epithet and saying, I am killing you because you are black, darn near.
Okay? Yeah. Yeah.
But you'll note that in Ferguson, there were two findings. One is that they couldn't pursue Darren Wilson, but for the pattern in practice, they could pursue Ferguson.
So we have two different standards.
One, which imagines that racism is sort of motivated in the moment and you wear a hood and you light a cross on fire. And that bar is too high for almost anybody.
Mm-hmm.
The other is looking at patterns and looking at the ways in which structures and situations tend to produce sets of outcomes.
Absolutely.
And that, we've got a bar that fits with the way that racism works in contemporary America.
And that, has worked in New Orleans, for example, in other places.
Yeah.
That has been his, that's been the weapon that Eric Holder was able to use.
Well, he's gone now.
He's gone now.
So we'll have to see what's happening.
Policy-wise, you're asking policy. I think that Hillary Clinton went further than Barack Obama has done in her speech on Monday. So her speech called for an end of these practices entirely, and she was really following the lead of Michelle Alexander, but she was specific.
Michelle Alexander, the author of the new Jim Crow.
And it was very, very specific about things like drug rehabilitation, and she didn't mention the DOJ burn grant, but that's where we would start. The federal burn grant is what provides local and state anti-drug forces their money, and they're incentivized to arrest black and brown bodies. So right now, as we speak, black people are 28 times more likely to be arrested for drug crimes than they were in 1982-83. Latinos, 22 times more likely. Whites, 8 times more likely. So what we need is a policy shift, but the only politician who's talked about a whole sea change, because you're right about Eric Holder, you're right about Obama, all around the edges, it's Hillary on Monday.
But I'm not sure.
We have to see if it realizes itself in, you know, if should she get to be in the position to make some changes. Right now, about the only thing that I can think that's maybe going to be uniform by default is police body cameras, perhaps. But let me switch the conversation just a little bit to this. You heard a lot in coming out of Baltimore specifically that really there are two conversations going on, two communities. Charm City, if you will, the street line, the Johns Hopkins, all of that. And on the other side, Freddie Gray's neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson really spoke about that being similar to something going on here in Boston.
We actually need to have dialogue. The Boston Public Schools needs to have a dialogue about what's going on in Baltimore. Our schools are 80% black and Latino. 7% Asian, 13% white, and most of the kids are poor. They need to have this conversation in their school. This is real social studies. This is a teachable moment for us as a country and as a city. And the other piece that we have to really think about with the Boston Police Department, with the mayor's office, as a council, and our, as a community, what's going on in Boston? There is a Mass Ave divide in Boston, in the Back Bay versus Roxbury. It's a 2-mile divide there. But we are light years away in life expectancy. There's a 32-year disparity in life expectancy from the Back Bay to Roxbury, 2 miles apart. And so the question is, how are we in political office, as a community, as a city, in leadership, how are we bridging that divide? How are we dealing with the fact that your zip code is more relevant to your life expectancy than your genetic code?
Well, and as we saw in Baltimore, in terms of unemployment, when we talk about poverty, the rate of unemployment in Freddie Gray's neighborhood is off the charts versus what's happening in the rest of the city overall. So if you talk about these two cities, how can Americans see each other and understand what's going on in the community? That's what's sort of what I was trying to get at earlier, is that there seems to be a disconnect about understanding. If you don't live there, you don't know, right?
I suppose so. I mean, you just get on the train and run right through it. I mean, it's right there. I don't know if there's a, is there a 32-year life expectancy difference between Back Bay? That seems rather dramatic.
I don't think that's, I understand the point that Tito Jackson was trying to make. And let me just make this observation. I thought about what he was saying the other day when I was downtown, and I watched thousands of people, you know, over a period of about an hour, just stream out of buildings. I was sitting there writing, and I was watching people stream out of the buildings where they work. And this is around South Boston, the Fort Point Channel. Do you know, I saw rarely a black, perhaps I didn't see a brown face, I'm not sure. But I was thinking about the fact that you have this job divide, this economic divide. One of the most developed parts of the city right now being developed is the Seaport area, and it's lacking color. What does that mean? It's not just a racial divide; it's a class divide. And so his point here, Tito's point here, and the same thing can be said about Baltimore. There are two Baltimores, and increasingly there are two Bostons. Well, you can't even afford the rent in Boston.
Is it more race than class, though?
I think it's both. 1968 is the last time we paid attention to urban rebellion and urban unrest, right? And that's in the aftermath of MLK's assassination. Now, between 63 and 69, there's over 300 civil disturbances in over 250 American cities. Everything from Detroit and Newark, but York, Pennsylvania, Plainfield, New Jersey, Oakland, Louisville, Kentucky. There were disturbances at times in Boston, although not a big eruption. This continued, but guess what? Our policies got worse. So in the 60s, we had a great society, right? And we still had trickle effects of the great society in the early 70s. By 73, there's stagflation, OPEC oil crisis, long gas lines by 77, 78. By 1980, Ronald Reagan says, poor people, it's your fault. Poor black people, especially you. And so Clinton and the Democrats double down on that. So what we're feeling is the results of 50 years of policy, but especially the last 35, there's two lost generations of African-American young people. And by lost, I don't mean we can't get them back, but lost in the sense of they lack literacy, they lack skills, they lack training. But unlike the African-American generation of the 60s that were poor, who we used to call surplus labor, these lost generations, we put them in prison, and there's a $1 billion prison economy connected to private and public prisons, and people are investing in prisons, including hip-hop companies and rap companies and music companies are investing in prison because it's a good investment.
Yeah. That's right.
Let me just say that we're going to go online to discuss the video that went viral of the quote-unquote hero mom, LaToya Brown, and her actions thereof.
Yeah.
So it's not quite a turn from what you just said, Peniel, but I definitely wanted to get into the discussion about the use of the word thug by both the mayor, who has now retracted what she said, by President Obama, who has kind of doubled down, speaking of double down, on his use of the word thug, and whether or not thug is racially coded. I say it is. You say, Phil Goff.
Yeah, I don't think there's much of a discussion to be had around
that. Well, for some it is. For some it is.
But we're educated people
here.
People
are hot.
And so it's, let me go ahead and just define it. It's done. It's racialized. I'm actually not super excited about the, it's the new, because we don't need a new one. We got the old one, and it keeps getting used in a terrible way, mm-hmm. right? I work lots of places in this country where people still use the old one. Mm-hmm. But of course it's racialized. Mm-hmm. I think more important than the question around just the word, though, is how much of black behavior and black culture do we want to give to black people? Do mm-hmm. we want to make it about black character? Because mm-hmm. I noticed that with hip-hop and with black male cool, we're very happy for that to be a cultural thing that people can pick up and put on, mm-hmm. right? But with mm-hmm. actual...
You could be a thug, is what you're saying, right, in the music.
No. You would be an MC.
Yes, you get to be a baller, right?
You get to be cool.
Yeah.
You get to have black male cool.
Gotcha.
You can pick that up. You can take it off, especially when it's time to go to your 9-to-5 job and make a lot of money.
Yeah.
But what we don't like to be able to put on and take off are the situations that afflict young black men in particular that gave birth to that, right? So we like the cultural byproducts of it, but we don't like the situational and social forces that created it. We make the social forces something that resides within the character of black people, particularly young black men, and we make the product something that, well, anybody can just pick that up.
To continue the conversation, see past episodes, or discover new stories, please visit our website at basicblack.org.
Economic problems through his lens, which were, again, it was shaded by culture. And, and I'm getting back to the very reason that Freddie Gray was picked up. He had no reason to be picked
up. That's right.
Right.
This man was picked up because of a profile, because of the continents that he projected, because of the assumptions that were made by police officers.
He was running away, and they didn't discover anything on him until they caught him, which was a knife.
And it wasn't illegal.
Marilyn Mosley, the biggest indictment was saying that the arrest was illegal.
Was illegal.
Yes.
That's
right.
So everything that follows thereafter is therefore corrupt.
Yeah. I asked about the thug question because it's vibrant out there.
No, and I think we need to explain it, Phil, really, in terms of to our audience, not to ourselves, because I completely agree.